Welcome back to the Making History series of podcasts. I'm Samuel McLean, I'm your host, and today we're talking about history and practice and precisely the different types of history and why history is being done. Today we are recording at King's College London in London, England, and I will let my guests introduce themselves.
Thanks, Sam. I'm Marcus Faulkner. I'm a teaching fellow here in the Department of War Studies. I suppose I'm a 20th century international historian, but my main areas of interest are naval history and sea power, and the other side of the coin really very much is intelligence history.
I'm Joshua Newton. I'm curator of world and maritime history at the National Maritime Museum. I'm primarily a historian of the Atlantic. My specific research interests are in West Africa in the 18th century, the British state, and the Atlantic slave trade.
As we said, in 2014, we're coming up to the 100th anniversary of the First World War, and there are many discussions about why history is being done. Are there different reasons or different types of history? Is it different to commemorate history or to celebrate history? You know, are these fundamentally different types of practices for history?
I mean, I think asking whether there are different types of history is probably a kind of a philosophical derail that we probably don't want to go down. But I think there are asking about whether these are different ways of engaging with the past is I think important. They can be distinct, but I think that there are areas in which they overlap. These aren't necessarily mutually exclusive ways of engaging with the past, but they are at times distinct modes.
Yes, you can get into a very philosophical discussion as to the purpose and the ultimate objectives of what history is about, but I'll come at it from a slightly more practical angle, and maybe throw up a question for you then, Sam, is... Yes, I do think where we are today and the different audiences that we talk to do create different levels of history, where there are different expectations, different methodologies, and different understandings as to what purpose the past has, and the difference between studying it for its own objective self and also influencing contemporary events or debates, etc. So you do have different levels of history, certainly.
This brings me nicely onto the next question then. How do the different types of audience influence the way that history is practiced or even taught? You mentioned there are different types of audiences. So how do you differentiate them?
Yes. In slightly crude and simplistic terms, I think, yes, you've got the differentiation between, should we call it, popular history and academic history. And what is the academic most interested in? And even that is a misleading term. But as a starting point, academics tend, dare I say it, to be more interested in the shaping of history and what actually influences perception and all the historiographical aspects, whereas in popular history you tend to focus more on the facts and the dates and the ideas, the methodology, not so much the methodologies, but technology, platforms in military history and the like. So at the very simplistic level, you have that differentiation between the objective and what history does.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, these can be very simplistic distinctions, but you know, at the level of popular history, there's, I think, a particular sort of preoccupation with what happened, with where things happened, why things happened, is sometimes interesting, but not in the same kind of sophisticated causal arguments that academics, so again, might, so crudely understood, might advance.
I think, interestingly, in the past couple of weeks, there has been a little bit of this storm about academic versus popular history. For example, the Australian popular historian Paul Hamm this past Saturday, which would be the 22nd of March, in one of the Australian newspapers, he really did launch a frontal assault on academic histories. And he basically condemned academic history as writing minutiae and that academic historians had no actual interest in having the wider world or, you know, the people who actually need to understand history in reading their works. And I think, you know, this is fairly interesting given that we're coming up to the First World War, the centenary, and there seems to be this difference between a public demand for an understanding or an answer to the First World War. You know, whether the First World War was morally right or morally wrong, or a more nuanced... Josh, you mentioned engagement with the past, which seems to be a much more dynamic way of expressing how history is practiced. So with the different types of audiences, whether it's the popular audience or the academic audience, is there really a difference between engagement or answering history?
I mean, I think that there's many different types of engagement with history, and that knowledge is inherently specialized. And the job, or at least one of the jobs of academics, is to probe in this sort of particularly specialized way. I don't see that as sort of an abrogation of a responsibility to communicate about the human past. In its advancing, you know, particular types and in particular domains of knowledge, it is as essential a task as communicating the big picture, the facts. I don't really sort of agree with the argument that sees sort of academic history as this sort of disconnected ivory tower kind of enterprise. It might lack, in some instances, the immediate impact of, say, a big, flashy popular history, but it's essential to an evolving understanding of what happened and why.
The case with the First World War centenary celebrations are rather special, shall we put it, and they are very emotive, as we've seen in the UK, well, develop over the last 3 months alone, and that's not going to end very soon. But I think the fundamental question is, what is the purpose of the entire activity? And again, that differentiation between academic and popular is slightly wrong also, because at the popular level, there are those people who generally just have a superficial understanding of events and just want to get a broad brushstrokes of why things happen. And there are also many people today who go to great lengths to understand the minutiae of something, who you might call the erudite enthusiast, of which there are many in the archives collecting facts and details, but who don't necessarily then have the understanding of the historiographical processes or the methodologies to make sense of all the facts they're collecting. So again, there's a slight differentiation there too. What the academic is there for, or should be there for, is to create some order in the mass of facts and details and draw out those processes and help people understand why certain things happened. I think what we've seen in conjunction with the centenary debates of the recent past is that the mixing of the events, the facts and details, with very contemporary views about why certain things happened and about the value of the war itself and why it was fought and its purpose and the like. And those are two very different things. You're superimposing present values upon past events without really understanding that it's something rather different.
I recall reading recently that here at the University of London, there is a debate whether the University of London student government should be represented officially at remembrance events. There was an argument that official recognition of remembrance events was to condone, very specifically, imperialism. And so it seems there is this idea amongst, you know, those who are not openly historians, whether to talk about events is then to celebrate and then to agree with what happened in those events. That, I mean, is there a trap there for historians?
Well, I don't think that to study something, I see where you're coming from, but I don't think to study something is in any way to celebrate it or to denigrate it one way or the other. It's what the objective of this study is and how it is put to use. I think when we are talking about audiences, what we have to differentiate often, and it's something that's not done, is between domestic and professional/international consumption also. I mean, there's a wonderful quote, or rather a tweet from a couple of weeks back, but which brought the centenary debate, at least crystallized in my mind. I can't remember who did this, but I can always find out. But somebody wrote, and I quote here, "Heavy emphasis on the Somme and the Pals turns World War I into an extension of British social and local history." And I couldn't agree more. You've got this very domestic view of the British commitment and engagement with the First World War, which is so divorced from the international study of it, and has very little little to do with that. And it poses all sorts of questions that simply don't exist outside of a certain British sphere. But there you have that differentiation between domestic consumption and the international audience or the professional academic audience who has a very different view of things. And you see that distinction also in various other fields.
It is just interesting to note, sort of, you just mentioned, you know, the idea of the psalm as being, you know, parochial in a particular kind of British context, which, you know, as a foreigner, precisely the opposite is true. I mean, that's, I don't think, at least in the US, there would be that kind of association. I mean, rather, that's the kind of core narrative of the war. That's where the mystique and the horror of the First World War lies, I think, for a substantial international audience.
Moving on to a related question. Josh, in your work at the museum, you know, there are constantly plans for the next gallery, the next book, the next big program.
Yes.
How does the arrival of centenaries and anniversary dates and things like that interact with potential audience in terms of how the museum works to create its plans for the future?
I mean, I think the first thing to say about that is that sort of about the kind of the psychological nature of the anniversary. Because, I mean, if you think about it, every year contains the anniversary for every event that is at least 1 year old. It's the psychologically interesting anniversaries that attract a lot of attention. So these are the hundreds and the 50s, and to a much lesser extent, the 25s. And those numbers have a particular base tens of psychological power. But that's something that's very real. The museum sector in general, the heritage sector, but you know, in particular, my institution is very keyed into. I mean, these are sort of important generators of interest. In one sense, they are historically meaningless. They don't actually represent, you know, anything particularly substantial about an understanding of the event. But they are key drivers for things like galleries, exhibitions, and books. So whenever possible at the National Maritime Museum, you know, we do seek to link in an anniversary, a commemoration, with a particular event or project. I mean, it's a strategy for the heritage sector that works, that's demanded.
Does the type of audience matter and when trying to work through these anniversaries?
Museum audiences are, I mean, there's no one museum audience. Galleries and exhibitions, you know, have to appeal to many simultaneously. So sort of within the kind of the public sphere generally, anniversaries and sort of associated gallery and exhibition projects have to work on a number of levels to appeal to a lot of different people. That's a bit different from how we might, say, do an academic project, a conference, or an academic book. An awareness of the landscape of anniversaries is sort of essential to public programming, sort of across a range of audiences.
So bring it back to you, Marcus. With your work in the creation of conferences and edited collections, but also in terms of course or planning of educational courses that you have done in the past, does anniversaries and these types of dates provide a focus for your new content as well?
Sammy, you've just covered a wide range of different activities there: conference, edited volumes, coursework. Where to start?
I think start with conferences.
Conferences are perhaps the most obvious, and it would be an extension, really, in the sense of what is going on in the museum sector also. Yes, conferences provide good starting points. We did this last year for the Battle of the Atlantic conference. The year before, we had a conference which wasn't related to a specific date. In a couple of weeks, I'm coming up to hosting a conference, not necessarily here, but also focused on a specific date. It's a useful reminder. It's a useful starting point for the discussion. In terms of an academic process or idea behind it, is perhaps less useful. I mean, when I suppose the area in which dates make the most sense as a historian is usually dates around which certain collections of papers are released to the public, as we have in the Public Records Office, which often then allows a particular new interpretation about something. You've got various levels of classification in that sort of regard. So there is an issue. So these days, yes, you have more conferences focused on dates, but I think that's also because the conferences that do take place on what we'll call the academic circuit are now designed to cater for much more wider audiences or different types of audience. So there is no such thing as a academic conference as might have been a long time ago. You're trying to draw in the public in different areas where it makes sense then, just like a museum exhibition, to host a 2014 conference on the origins of the First World War, or rather the naval component of the First World War, where there is one in Portsmouth later on this year. That makes sense. Edited volumes, it's a little harder there because the gestation period of an edited volume is usually a number of years, particularly when you're dealing with historians coming from a wide variety, not any historians, but academics coming from a wide variety of institutions, perhaps drawn from an international ensemble or the like. It simply takes longer. The idea that you can turn around a volume in a year with maybe 10 or 20 distinct chapters is perhaps optimistic. So I don't think you're producing edited volumes for a particular date or even in after a conference, the proceedings.
How does that compare to this sort of time cycle for museums as well?
I think, just as a sort of side note, I think dates are also only as effective as they are, you know, popular or widely known. When did Cook begin and end his first voyage? Many of my colleagues at the National Maritime Museum will be able to answer that question. Many people in the wider public won't be able to. But that doesn't mean that Cook's voyages aren't interesting to a large number of people. Dates really work for the kind of the big, often recent, sort of canonical events of major wars or coronation dates or the signing of particular treaties. They only work up to a particular point. So where possible, the museum tries to incorporate that. You know, sometimes, even if a date isn't particularly well known, if you can say that this is going to be the 200th anniversary of, you know, whatever we happen to be having a gallery or an exhibition about, that certainly adds something to the kind of publicity blitz for it. But, in terms of things like the First World War, I mean, that is something that the National Maritime Museum has been thinking and planning about for an extremely long time. Sort of headline acts are things that we're thinking about in our strategic process many years in advance.
Recently, a colleague of mine was telling me about the differences about the point of view of why 2014 was important. You know, for the British, obviously, it's the First World War. As a Canadian, for me, it's more important because it's 75 years since the beginning of the Second World War. But my colleague was told me about a discussion he had with his German friends, who were saying that 2014 is more important for the Berlin Wall than for anything else. And so, in Germany, the idea of the First World War as a national historical event was third or fourth on the list. And so it's this idea of first your domestic audience, and then you also have this international audience. These dates and the anniversaries may not mean the same thing for all the major players involved. 2014 is also the end of the War of 1812, but unless you're Canadian, that doesn't mean very much at all.
Well, I mean, that's an important point. You know, the dates have multiple sort of significances. If you consider 2007 as the bicentenary of the 1807 Act of Abolition, that's something that received a lot of attention in Britain. It was also the 300th anniversary of the Act of Union, which was commemorated much, much more quietly than the Act of Abolition. So in the observance, you can sort of see something about sort of public or at least government, sort of priorities behind commemorating particular events. And commemorations themselves have a particular history. So 2007, much was made of the abolition of the slave trade. In 1907, there was virtually no public mention of it.
Yes, I mean, when we're talking about commemorations and dates being vehicles to remember certain things, it's a product of a space and time in which you're operating. If that date doesn't mean very much to the broader audience, then there's very little point in pushing the issue, be it in terms of publishing, be it in terms of conferences, or whatever else you are trying to do, because it simply doesn't resonate. But you do get an issue of trying to create some sort of equality where everybody needs to be part of a process, where you get sometimes rather strange things being commemorated just because they need to fit into a particular point in time. I mean, the way that the First World War is seen in 2014 is fundamentally different to the way it was even just 10 or 20 years ago. Very different things at work. I think we've seen this now also recently in the way that Niall Ferguson's work has been treated over the recent weeks in comparison to when it originally came out 10, 15 years ago. Very different views and points to consider there.
Generally, you broach the topic of history as public relations. How much are governments and larger institutions driving this need to look at anniversaries for celebration, for commemoration? Is this a trend that comes from within the historical profession, or is it more driven by outside factors?
Big topic, that one, Sam. I mean, you could see it in slightly different ways. I mean, the question is it the government or an institution pushing it, or is there an expectation within the public to celebrate, to commemorate, to investigate a certain topic? I think there are probably parts of the British government who would prefer the First World War simply to go away because it's causing extra budgetary constraints or inopportune moments, whereas other parts of the government machinery certainly wish to commemorate and focus public opinion. And I think, at least in regards to the centenary celebration, there is an expectation that certain things are done, that certain things are celebrated or commemorated on the part of the public, or elements of the public. So I think that it's almost too broad to give a specific answer to.
I find it interesting, this idea that historical events and commemorations provide a budgetary pressure that need not, some might think need not be there. There is a finite amount of resources that are available in the academic world. You can only have so many conferences a year. You can only have so many journal articles, so much historical output. Is there at times a domination of the output by these anniversaries?
I mean, it's also a very complicated, very broad question. But I think that anniversaries and commemorations can sometimes unlock a tremendous amount of funding and energy behind a particular topic that, you know, in that period can allow a kind of flourishing of that topic. I mean, that's, you know, for the history of the Atlantic slave trade, for the history of abolition and the later suppression of the slave trade in 1807, 2007 proved to be tremendously sort of, you know, productive period of public memory. I mean, particularly the National Maritime Museum, we did two collaborative doctoral projects that were specifically keyed to 2007 about anti-slavery in the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. The amount of work that's been done on the subject in the years leading up to 2007, and then the output from projects that began in 2007 have really transformed the field in a really big way. The flip side of that is that the subject, you know, runs the risk of being forgotten after the anniversary has passed. All of the energy has run out. That certainly, you know, can...
Or has the funding run out?
Well, sometimes it's the funding, and sometimes it's really sort of, you know, a sense that the moment has passed, at least for now. Sense that 2007 is years ago, we've done the slave trade nationally and as an institution. What's next is a kind of question that for historians of the slave trade, you know, just to use this particular example because it's what I know best, is disappointing and maybe a little dangerous.
In terms of the creating of university courses, new programs, is it the same influence when there's maybe not with government funding to create courses, for example, but if a number of students have an interest, for example, there, you know, there are university courses on the First World War, or is it the same kind of thing where suddenly there is the interest and therefore the tuition funds available to study these things?
I do think it's a case of tuition funds that doesn't factor into it as much or at all. I think you have to be a little bit careful here. Also, you've got all sorts of different types of institutions and different objectives behind it. As a general rule, though, I would say this plays less of a role. You're right, in regards to the First World War, there are a number of programs and courses have multiplied over the last few years, but I would say that that's a special case of just the magnitude of the First World War needs to be digested. But usually what's the objective behind the university course or a larger program? There's something else behind it. It's to teach methodologies, it's to teach skills and to teach processes, which shouldn't necessarily be reacting or being on the back of a particular event, a causal event, which usually is, as Joshua has pointed out, something in the political or military realm, but that date alone is rather meaningless. So, yes, I can't speak for all universities or colleges worldwide, and some no doubt do that, but I would think that the objective behind higher education to shape opinions and to demonstrate how processes come about and to critical thought on the part of the students is not one that you can necessarily connect up to these moments in time which need to be put into some other context.
Excellent. Well, I'd like to thank Marcus and Joshua for joining me today. It's been an excellent conversation. Thank you, gentlemen.
Very welcome.
Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.